You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 30th of April 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
Good evening. Here we are, the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Like a porn star says when she's about to have sex with a Trump, let's get this over with.
America's media loses its collective mind over a comedian telling jokes. My guests Florence Biedermann and Ivor Gaber will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including the resignation of the UK's Home Secretary, but should her predecessor, i.e. the current Prime Minister, follow suit? President Emmanuel Macron embarks on another overseas trip. Will Australia swoon as readily as the United States? And will a supermarket merger necessitate a recalibration of British snobbery? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Ivor Gaber, Professor of Political Journalism at the University of Sussex, and Florence Biedermann, the London Bureau Chief for Agence France-Presse. Welcome both. And first, with all due apology to Thomas Macaulay and his famous characterization of the British public, we truly do know no spectacle so ridiculous as the American media in one of its periodical fits of morality. This past weekend, the White House Correspondents' Association held its annual dinner, traditionally a ceremony of solemn self-congratulation, lightened by some humorous remarks from guests. This year, one such was the comedian Michelle Wolf, who told some jokes, as comedians will. To consume the outraged coverage since, one might assume she'd set fire to the building. Here is a sample of her routine.
I'm here to make jokes. I have no agenda. I'm not trying to get anything accomplished. So everyone that's here from Congress, you should feel right at home. And I know, as much as some of you might want me to, it's 2018 and I'm a woman, so you cannot shut me up. Unless you have Michael Cohen wire me $130,000. Trump isn't here, if you haven't noticed. He's not here. And I know I would drag him here myself, but it turns out the President of the United States is the one pussy you're not allowed to grab.
Michelle Wolf there at the White House Correspondents' Association dinner. Florence, first of all, a large number of serious, grown-up, mainstream American journalists have made great play of not being at all amused by any of this. What is everybody being so purse-lipped and purse-clutching about?
Maybe the vulgarity or the rudeness of Michelle Wolf. I think it's not very usual. Like, you can make jokes, but I guess polite jokes in this environment normally. What I found really interesting and funny, by the way, is that in a way, the rudeness of the jokes were corresponding to some rude characters of Trump himself, like the allusion to the pussy. I mean, it's coming from a quote from the president himself. So yes, what shocked so much the journalists is the change of atmosphere. And the choice of a comic that really unbalanced them with that vulgarity and that crude jokes.
I did enjoy earlier the suggestion by Tim Miller, a former Republican operative, that next year the comedian should just read out some of Donald Trump's attempted jokes from the last two or three years that everybody has sought to dismiss as locker room banter and see if anybody else laughs. Ivor, is what we're witnessing in terms of the reaction here just the traditional epic self-regard of the American media, or is it something else?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. There is a long tradition of this, and I mean, I remember
perhaps of the White House Correspondents' Dinner, yes, or American media self-regard.
Both, actually. Both. Thanks for pointing that out. No, a hilarious sequence when George W. Bush was sitting there, to his credit, he turned up and being mercilessly pilloried. It is a tradition, and it's an interesting contrast because on the one hand, I once attended a White House press briefing and I was shocked how the press corps stood up when the president came in the office, that came into the briefing room, whereas in an equivalent event in the UK, the last thing we would do would be to stand up. We don't stand up for the Prime Minister. On the other hand, we're not quite as rude to our politicians in public. There is an equivalent in the UK, it's called the press gallery lunch. And there's a little bit of ribbing of the, and it's off the record, or it's actually sort of off the record, but seems to slip on the record. There's a little bit of ribbing, but nothing like this. I think it's very odd, actually, this whole tradition in America. It doesn't quite make sense if you see the day-to-day dialogue between the press and the president, which is much more respectful and deferential than it is here.
I mean, there is, Florence, an American tradition of a comedy set piece called The Roast, in which various people are invited to take the stage and insult the guest of honour, who is usually expected to sit there and absorb it with good grace, as indeed Donald Trump once did when Comedy Central had him on as the object of one of their celebrity roasts. He appeared to be genuinely amused by some of it, though it is hard to tell where Trump's concerned. But in terms of the reaction as well from Trump's political allies, Florence, who have, of course, condemned Michelle Wolf's routine as crass and vulgar and all these other kind of things, do they care how ridiculous this sounds given the person they are defending?
I don't think they find the person that they find ridiculous. That's a question of appreciation. But whatever, I mean, you couldn't imagine. I still admire the practice. I mean, you couldn't imagine something like that in France, for example. So whatever is happening, the fact that comics are invited to talk before a president or before politicians and to make jokes about them is a practice we could dream of in France, because you would have the same humorist on the radio, but never you would have such a lack of respect or so-called lack of respect for the president.
But you'd never have a president like Trump, would you? I mean, that's the other issue.
Well, let's not tempt fate. Ivor, the White House Correspondents Association issued an insufferably prissy and sanctimonious statement, frankly apologising for Michelle Wolf, as if they were appalled that a comedian turned up and told a lot of jokes. They said her monologue was not in the spirit of our mission, which is the kind of thing that you would never hear any British or indeed Australian journalist uttering with a straight face. Are they just grovelling to try and keep their access to the president?
Possibly, but there's also, when we come to American journalists, they do have... They do have an obsession with the First Amendment, and they do think the guarantees the right to freedom of speech. They do think they're carrying this torch on behalf of the American Constitution. They do.
Isn't that what Michelle Wolf was doing as well?
Yeah. Yes. Indeed, I suppose they have different interpretation, but it seems to me, in general, it's awful to generalise about God knows how many thousand American journalists, but they do take themselves, I mean, pompously serious. But on the other hand, they also do very good works. I mean, I think because they took themselves so seriously, we had the revelations going back to Watergate or Pentagon Papers or more recent ones that meant that some American journalists were prepared to risk prison to exercise their First Amendment rights. So, yeah, they do take themselves seriously. And I'm not a great fan of the American press in general. If you go outside New York, or if you go to the what's called flyover country between New York and the West Coast, the quality of the daily newspapers and daily news shows is frankly not very high. So I think the American media is rather variegated, and it's good, bad and indifferent, and there's a lot of indifferent.
Okay, well, let's move seamlessly along to a story in the United Kingdom, which was also broken by diligent and serious journalists doing their jobs properly. And this was the astounding scandal around the atrocious treatment of some British citizens who had arrived here from the Caribbean and or their descendants. It has today resulted, or rather late last night, resulted in the resignation of the Home Secretary, Amber Rudd. She has been replaced by Sajid Javid. Rudd had clung on gamely for some while, but she finally quit after leaked memos revealed that she had misled Parliament, she claimed inadvertently, about whether the Home Office maintained targets for deportations. Florence, first of all, do you think we yet fully understand how big a scandal this is? Because it is outrageous. We aren't yet sure, but it does now seem more than likely that actual British citizens were deported back to a country that some of them had barely even visited.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very serious story. It has already cost the head of a minister. And what the opposition, the Labour opposition now is looking for is for Theresa May to come and explain, because Amber Rudd has been kind of her shield, but she was the one who was in charge at the Interior Ministry when all this happened. And it happens in this atmosphere, like since several years in Europe generally, but also here, and which also... finally had as a result Brexit, like in an atmosphere where the foreigner, the immigrant is considered as a target and an enemy. And in this case, yes, what is really troubling is people who are actually entitled to have the British citizenship.
Ivor, on the subject of how exposed or otherwise the Prime Minister now is by this, is she potentially in trouble here? Because she was, of course, the Home Secretary prior to Amber Rudd, and it was on her watch that quite a lot of this appears to have occurred.
Indeed. She's lost her human shield, as somebody said. The hostile environment which led to these dreadful events, which forced, really, civil servants to do everything they could to assume that they're going to throw somebody out rather than accept them, was Mrs. May's own phrase, and she proudly trumpeted it. And I suspect it didn't hinder it. It was of some help when she was able to assume the leadership of the Conservative Party. She was seen as tough on immigration, so it does come back to her. And I do think it depends on whether Amber Rudd feels badly done by. This is the former Home Secretary. If she decides that Mrs. May is the ultimate culprit, it will be interesting to see to the extent to which she plays a role in seeking to make that public. Of course, we all live in the land of unforeseen consequences, because if Mrs. May is forced to resign, who knows what?
Florence, as one of at least two foreigners at this table, myself being another, is it your perception that Britain has become noticeably more hostile to immigrants and foreigners generally in the last few years?
This is one of the analyses many people made of the vote for Brexit. I mean, this environment, again, which is not only in Britain but in Europe generally, also in the United States, this environment where people feel threatened by the presence of foreigners. So it has been the cause of those populist movements in Europe. So it's something larger than Britain, but Britain is part of it. And what I still admire as a foreigner in this country is that the person who has been appointed to replace Amber Rudd is himself an immigrant of the second generation, the son of a Pakistani bus driver. And this is not really imaginable in a country like France at the moment. So he's also part of this, you know, very multicultural side in this country, like Sadiq Khan. Another thing that would be unthinkable in France, like a Muslim migrant of the second generation being the mayor of Paris. So that there are the both sides for me. To me, yes, of course, there is this atmosphere of closure, like Brexit. We don't want more EU immigrants. We don't like them too much. We don't want to be flooded with immigrants. There is this side, which is, again, not typically British. And there is still this multiculturalism that can be admired, and which I admire as a French.
Because Ivor, the picture is, as Florence suggests, it's quite confused in that there's no doubt that there was hostility to immigration underpinning the Brexit vote, but that was mostly hostility to immigration from elsewhere in Europe, or to reduce it to the basic point, that was immigration of white people that they were hostile to. Yet all the polls conducted since what has become known as the Windrush scandal broke reflect overwhelming support for these Caribbean immigrants who are British citizens and who have been treated monstrously.
Up to a point. I'm not sure I agree that the Brexit, the element of anti-immigrant feeling in the Brexit vote was only confined to Europeans. It's not for nothing that one of the, what should we call it, maverick leave campaigns had a big poster showing Syrian and Afghanistani refugees flooding into Europe.
Do you think Brexit voters didn't fully appreciate that Syria and Afghanistan are not part of the EU?
Well, no, but I do think they thought that the EU is allowing them in, particularly Germany is allowing them in, how long before they come here. I do think in some parts of this country there is an underlying racism, and I do think that was an element. I think it's wrong to attribute the entire Brexit vote to it at all. But I do think, although we do have an Asian mayor of London and now an Asian Home Secretary, I think that's in London. I do think there are other parts of the country where that would be, in your words, unthinkable. And I don't think the situation is as sanguine. I wouldn't be sanguine about the fact that British population think the Windrush is a scandal. I do think that's because the people presented are old, friendly West Indian cleaners or bus conductors or whatever, very non-threatening characters, say to them, Islamic youth, and you'll get a different reaction. And I think we have to be careful to make the difference.
Florence, this seems to have come about, the full story has not yet emerged, as a result of this hostile environment regime imposed by Theresa May during her time as Home Secretary. But as she will doubtless explain again and again and again, she was talking about creating a hostile environment for illegal immigrants, which, you know, has spilled over, as these things often can. At heart, though, is there anything actually basically wrong with seeking to identify and remove illegal immigrants from a given country? Because surely that's the point at which public faith in immigration policy breaks down, if people start to think the rules are not being enforced.
But the whole point of WinRush is to show that people who were actually allowed had to produce like paper documents that they didn't have anymore, or that even have been destroyed by the British administration. So the WinRush story is not something on illegal immigrants. It's on legal immigration, but from people that you don't want to acknowledge as part of the country because they come from a different environment. That is really shocking in the story. As to fight against illegal immigration, of course, I mean, no government, no citizens would be against it, but based on really the selection of people which you allow to stay, not on quota where you have to decide those have to go anyway. So that's the shocking side also of the story.
Just as a final quick thought on this one, Ivor, just thinking of it in terms of basic politics, does it strike you that this story might still have a way to run?
The WinRush story, yeah. Certainly, I think it will. And it's linked to this notion of using targets to deal with a very human issue, as Florence says. You if you set targets, then you sweep up the illegal immigrant and the legal immigrant, and that's what happened. And I think journalists will find more and more great WinRush stories, as they say in the newsroom. And I think this one will run and run, and certainly the Labour opposition will do its best to make sure it does.
OK, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Florence Biedermann and Ivor Gaber. Coming up next, President Emmanuel Macron prepares for a slightly less weird overseas visit.
Monocle's May issue invites you to hang out with the world's brightest-eyed, bushiest-tailed new world leader. Jacinda Ardern is New Zealand's Prime Minister on a mission to turn her lively first 100 days in office into years of growth and good vibrations. Talking of which, we switch to California, dreaming of a modernist Mecca under cloudless skies, happy people in lovely homes. We're moving to LA, incidentally. Elsewhere, let us show you fauna, dogs like this guy, coughing cartoons like these, porcelain pets, pussies, pilchards. We also suspend our disbelief with a visit to the studio of the artist and the set designer Ez Devlin, who's done big things for Adele and Beyoncé. We take five with jazz saviour Kamasi Washington, we sit pretty and count down our 50 favourite design innovations and marvel at Belgrade's Palace of Serbia and its marble rigour and surreal spotlessness. It's always a good time for a glass of something fortifying, of course, and so we have a vino with Adam Gopnik, hello Adam, a flirtini in Yokohama, and finish the bottle with these kiwis. And we're back to New Zealand then. Why are these suitcases smiling? Well, now you know why. Monocle's May issue is out now. Get your copy today or subscribe at monocle.com.
You are back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Florence Biedermann and Ivor Gaber. Now, if I've calculated the time zones correctly, as we go to air, President Emmanuel Macron of France is nearing that point of a flight to Australia's east coast at which you are caught between excitement at entering the airspace of the country and realising you've still got another 5 hours to go and you've already watched all the films. His stay in Australia, it's the first strictly bilateral visit by any French president, will probably be somewhat less bizarre than his recent excursion to Washington, on the grounds that Australia's current Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, can be basically trusted in adult company and probably won't want to hold hands with him. Florence, first of all, President Macron got quite good reviews for his trip to Washington, as he does seem to get most places he goes. Is it one of those things where he's more popular outside France than in it?
It's difficult to say. He's it varies in France. You know, sometimes he has very bad percentage of popularity, sometimes it goes up. So I think it's fluctuating and it's a bit difficult to say whether he's very popular, moderately popular. So people don't know yet, you know, what he will achieve, what to make of him. And I think it's a bit the same when he goes abroad. Like, yes, everybody was enthusiastic because he's a friend of Donald Trump. But now everybody's also waiting to see if he can translate that in concrete acts. And we will have an answer on the 12th of May, like to see whether his friendship was enough to convince Trump not to withdraw from the Iran nuclear agreement. So that's how it is with Emmanuel Macron. He's very charming, he's very smart, he's brilliant. Wherever he goes, it's kind of the Midas touch. Everybody smile and say, wow, he's great. Everybody's great around. And he has this talent, which is a talent. And again, he's a very articulate man. Let's see what the concrete results are. And I think they won't be as obvious as the show, for example, he was putting with Donald Trump planting a tree that disappeared 2 days after he left the country.
President Macron clearly enjoys the being on the world stage aspect of being president. What have you made of how he presents himself so far?
Well, I do think your point, I defer to Florence about his popularity in France, but it does seem to be that he presents well internationally. I don't know what his poll ratings are here, but I imagine they're probably a little bit better than Mrs. May's. He does project this sort of all things to all people, which helps greatly. So Mr. Trump, although to be fair, he did tell Mr. Trump a thing or two about politics after they'd had their meeting, but he does appear to be very user-friendly wherever he goes. How that will go down in Australia, I'm not too sure, because I don't think, and I'm trying to defer to your superior knowledge, Andrew, and not offend you, but Australian politics aren't always the most sophisticated. And I just wonder if Macron is a little too sophisticated for Australian journalists and politicians' taste.
But I don't know. I think Malcolm Turnbull knows, you know, which fork to start with, and so forth. I don't anticipate any faux pas or of that nature.
And besides, I would add, if you are someone clever like Macron, you are that clever that you make the other feel clever.
And, of course, talking about clever Mr. Macron, and, of course, in Britain we talk about people being too clever by half, but talking about me, I think it's very clever that he is seeking to be Australia's bridge to Europe after the UK is no longer in that position.
Well, that may be a two-way street, because Australia is, of course, going to want a relationship with the EU, and it will not now be able to conduct that via the prism of the United Kingdom. So it's easy to see the importance of this relationship now from Australia's point of view. But Florence, to what extent is France's relationship with Australia a hot talking point in the saloons of France?
I don't know how many people could tell you the name of the Australian Prime Minister in France. I guess it's a very, very low percentage. So, well, you rarely hear about Australia. I mean, French politics, it barely exists.
I mean, it's quite heartwarming, because there was a long period during which I was growing up in Australia in which the two countries did not get on at all. And indeed,
the nuclear tests,
well, exactly,
yeah.
And the whole blowing up a civilian boat in a New Zealand harbour, that kind of thing. But, I mean, there was genuinely a period at which you would no more have turned up at a fashionable dinner party with a bottle of French wine than you would with a bottle of South African. So this is an improvement on that.
Yeah, this was Gaullist time. It's over. Like, we are not making any atom test in this area anymore. I think, yes, he can hope, Emmanuel Macron can hope to have a better relationship. But even strategically, I mean, it's not a big country on the map. And the proof is, it's the first bilateral visit by French president.
But that said, we are about to buy a quantity of submarines from France.
Oh, you, sorry.
That is Australia. and also, in fairness, our winemakers have stopped calling their fizzy drink champagne, which I suspect may have smoothed over a certain amount.
Yeah, but they still think they are doing good wine.
But also,
is fighting talk.
France is keeping a toehold in the South Pacific, or trying to. There is, as we know, a reference referendum coming up in New Caledonia.
Which President Macron is also visiting.
And he is going there saying, do not leave the warm embrace of France. And I'm not sure how well that will go down in Australia, which certainly sees the South Pacific as its playground more than a European one.
OK, well, finally tonight, the merger of two supermarket chains is not usually an event freighted with particular social import. But in the still weirdly class-obsessed United Kingdom, considerable effort is being expended, reading the runes of an amalgamation of Sainsbury's and Asda. In British class terms, Sainsbury's have traded down a couple of rungs. Will their customers be prepared to go along with it? Ivor, we should ask you first, just basically and briefly, could you delineate the hierarchy of supermarket snobbery in this country?
How long have we got? Right top of the tree where, of
three
course...
3.5 minutes is the answer to that question.
Marks and Spencer's have a food...
Hang on. Marks and Spencer's is top of the tree? This is controversial.
Above Waitrose.
Well, exactly.
No, Marks Spencer's is more expensive than Waitrose, let me tell you bitterly.
That doesn't necessarily put it at the top of the snob tree.
Well,
it's not all about cost.
Okay, Marks and Spencer's and Waitrose, which is part of the John Lewis partnership, which is allegedly a top of the tree. I was just being controversial, Andrew. And then we come to Sainsbury's, middle class is probably the wrong term, but white collar workers, let's say. Then we come to Tesco, which is still the biggest, which started off as working class, but much of it... You see, I'm going to stop because these supermarkets are very clever, because you go into Tesco in London, it has a very different range from a middle-class range of food, if you like, than if you go into Tesco in Huddersfield. Nothing against Huddersfield, but there are fewer middle-class people. So these supermarkets are very good chameleon-like. If I can just add, of course, at the bottom of the tree, what you want me to say is Asda, which is involved, which serves a working-class market. But, and here's where I'm just going to throw you completely, people regard what the discount stores, which are essentially German stores called Lidl's and Asda... Little and help me out, what's the second
job? Aldi.
Aldi. But actually, a lot of us trendy middle classes go there because we're trying to be a bit of reverse snobbery. Look at us. Aren't we egalitarian? We shop at Lidl's and Aldi.
I can confirm that Poundland is really good for domestic cleaning products. Florence, I live in a part of London that real estate agents characterise as up and coming. And I do know that every time any sufficiently sized retail property closes, the local community discussion boards light up with speculation that it's going to be a Waitrose. It's the thing that everybody gets excited about. It. Is there a French equivalent to any of this?
Yes, of course. I mean, there is exactly the same categories. We have Aldi and Lidl, and yes, if you are hype, like, you would go to Aldi and Lidl because you live in that kind of area, which is mixed, like, with... and then you have the middle one that would be Franprix. Exactly the same nuance, because it's also linked, like, to revenues, to the kind of area you live in, and I think that there are those nuances. But we don't have that difference like Waitrose and Marks and Spencer. I cannot find an equivalent with the nuance between the two that you have here.
There's similar strata in Australia, and I speak with some relief that my brother no longer lives round the corner from a Thomas Ducks outlet in Sydney, where the coffee, I am here to confirm, is slightly more expensive than Gold Dust. But that was very much at the sort of top.
Thomas
of the,
Duck sounds a very unclassy name for what you're saying. It's
Dux. See, it's practically Latin.
Or as near as the Australians can get.
Well, careful now. I mean, just finally on this.
And you said they were not that sophisticated.
Just finally on this, Ivor. How are Sainsbury's going to pitch this?
Well, I think it's very interesting. We're calling it a merger, but most of the bosses are going to be Sainsbury bosses. I think we should have added, if this goes ahead, and it is subject to probably a government review, it will make it by far and away the biggest supermarket group in the UK. And I think Sainsbury's are trying to grab the Asda market rather than let Asda grab the Sainsbury market. Watch this space, as they say.
Well, that does bring us to the end of today's show. Ivor Gaber and Florence Biederman, thank you for joining us at Midori House. The show was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Megan Atkinson. Our studio manager was David Stevens. Music next at 1900. It's the Culture Show. There's more on the day's main stories on the Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at 1800 London time tomorrow. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.